The DRC, as country, has been playing a critical role on supply chain of cobalt. We supply the chain with about 70% of the global demand of cobalt. But we are struggling to actually capture benefits from cobalt exportation.
We need to secure energy and electricity for these Africans working on the continent. It's not enough for this revolution to actually pass us by.
Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. This is part 3 in our mini-series, Dig Baby Dig. So far, we've taken you to Peru, where the government of Dina Boluarte is determined to inflict a hated copper mining project on the people of the Tambo Valley.
This government is very pro-mining, it's very pro-big mining, and they see this, the need for critical minerals, as an opportunity to just go hell for leather.
And we've also taken you to Serbia, where a transnational mining giant is trying to dig for lithium in spite of widespread and historic public protests.
Particularly now, 5 years into the national campaign against this mine, that actually the campaign is no longer against the mine, it's just for the land. It's for the preservation of that land and nature.
In the final episode of this series, we're taking you to the Democratic Republic of Congo, or the DRC. From the copper cables in our electricity grids to the EVs multiplying on our roads, the energy transition depends on the DRC. But corruption, pollution, and child labor have long blighted the country's cobalt industry. Kat Rainsford, an investigator with the campaigning organization Global Witness, wrote about this as part of the big story in our recent magazine on critical minerals. She looked at whether there is any way of turning the country's critical mineral wealth into a blessing rather than a burden. To help unpack this piece, I spoke to two of Kat's colleagues who have worked on the ground in the DRC.
My name is Alaka Lugonzo. I am the Senior Civil Society Advisor working under the Transition Minerals Campaign at Global Witness.
I'm Jean-Pierre Okenda. I'm a senior researcher and a human rights, as well as a lawyer focusing on the governance of mining sector in the DRC. Currently, I'm Executive Director of an NGO called Sentinel of Natural Resources, which is basically to say that our role is to keep natural resources in the Congo.
Kat's piece begins with the story of a woman we'll call Marie. Marie used to live in Kabombwa, a peaceful farming village of more than 1,000 people in the south of the DRC. When the Chinese-owned Tenke Fugurume mine built a factory upstream, villagers like Marie started to notice the water from the nearby river was irritating their skin. She described other symptoms, like a swollen stomach, nosebleeds, choking, dry throat, coughing, breathing difficulties, and skin rashes. A 2024 report by the NGO RAID cited evidence of widespread health impacts from polluted water associated with numerous mines throughout the copper-cobalt belt of southern DRC. Alarmingly, there's mounting evidence of severe gynecological impacts on women, from urinary infections to miscarriages and birth defects. The TFM factory, which produced quicklime used to process cobalt ores, was allowing untreated wastewater to drain into the nearby river. Village elders told the Congolese advocacy group AfriWatch they believed 11 people had died due to pollution-related disease. TFM insisted that scientific tests showed no link between their factory and reported diseases. Still, the government eventually agreed the community would be paid to relocate, following experts' recommendations. But villagers objected that the resettlement was partial and substandard, and the compensation offered was a fraction of the value of the homes they would lose.
The project has been polluting water, polluting soil, polluting air, so polluting everything, and causing the community to actually move from the land, you see. And some communities are moved twice, you see. And moving community twice is something that is really unacceptable. So as you can see, basically, so you are in a situation where communities are not benefiting from the mine, but they are paying a huge cost. So you will see that most of rivers in Congo, they don't have fish now. So the situation is horrible.
According to evidence analyzed and corroborated by Global Witness, in September 2023, as the villagers protested for a fairer deal, Congolese security forces arrived, triggering 2 days of violent clashes, including alleged firing on civilians. the army denied the incident. Global Witness has mapped 334 incidents of violence or protest related to four critical minerals in 19 major producing countries between 2021 and 2023. All 13 recorded incidents relating to cobalt were registered in the DRC's copper-cobalt belt, which is almost certainly an underestimate. Jean-Pierre tells me that mining currently accounts for between 50 to 60% of Congo's entire state budget. And with the DRC's cobalt production predicted to double between 2021 and 2028, the pressure is mounting.
So basically, let us say that really it's mining and especially copper and the cobalt, they are at the heart of the Congolese economy.
The cobalt sector is dominated by at least 19 industrial mines, with major investors including China's Zijin Mining and CMOC Group, Luxembourg-registered Eurasian Resources Group, and Swiss commodities giant Glencore. But despite its tremendous resources and foreign investment into its mining sector, the DRC has yet to see its own economy develop in a way that serves its people. It remains among the world's five poorest countries, and three-quarters of the population live on less than $2 a day. The sector is characterized by forced labor, conflict, massive wealth extraction, and environmental degradation. For years, copper and cobalt mining has been enriching tech companies at the expense of countless Congolese lives.
We see the huge gaps between all these statistics in terms of the production of cobalt and the copper we see, and the poverty in the ground, I'm telling you, is really huge, I'm telling you.
Jean-Pierre is based between the capital Kinshasa and the city of Lubumbashi, which is often referred to as the mining capital of the DRC. He regularly meets with community members on the ground in mining regions and has witnessed many of the human rights violations and environmental costs firsthand. He explains that while the mining sector should, in theory, create plenty of local jobs, the reality is that many are filled by agency workers from abroad, allowing international companies to cut costs, avoid liability, and prevent unionization. He says there's no enforcement of the law to protect labor rights.
One of the ways for the country or mining companies to share the benefits from cobalt is actually to pay, you know, to improve labor conditions, to make sure that those Congolese that are working there, you know, including foreign, you know, citizens, that they are protected, that they can benefit from it.
According to Congolese law, the maximum legal working time cannot exceed 45 hours per week and 8 hours per day. But he says this law isn't really being followed.
You know, they are working, they are looking a lot. No one is there to respect, make sure that this our law is actually respected in the Congo. You know, talking about water, do they have access to water? Is there any freedom of expression to them, you know, in terms of the trade union, you see, because basically the law imposed that each company should make sure that they guarantee the freedom of workers to be part of trade union. So there's no freedom. So I'm telling you, in general, the situation is very, very bad in the ground.
Here's Alaka.
A few years ago, the Business and Human Rights Resource Center put out an article on working conditions of the mine workers in DRC, which of course they mentioned about serious labor rights, as is mentioned, labor rights abuses. Also, they were talking about how there was low pay, they're subjected to excessive working hours, you know, quite degrading treatment whereby you find the workers are kicked, they are slapped, they are beaten, they're insulted. Also discrimination, there's a lot of discrimination and racism. They do not have protective gear. And of course, disregard to basic, you know, these health provisions.
In its latest report released in July, the Business and Human Rights Resource Center found that human rights risks are increasing across the renewable energy value chain, with a total of 95 lawsuits initiated globally since 2009.
At the end of the day, everyone is looking to secure the supply, you know, of these minerals, especially the coltan and the cobalt, but they're just turning a blind eye to some of these human rights and labor abuses. And I think it's quite sad to watch that.
Hard-won reforms were made to the mining code in 2018 after years of advocacy by Congolese civil society, including Jean-Pierre's Sentinel Natural Resources. The new code increased mineral royalties and required mining companies to contribute to development funds, conduct environmental impact assessments, and set out protections for displaced villages. But without proper enforcement, this means little. Jean-Pierre says his group is working on convincing groups buying minerals from the Congo to actually follow these rules.
What we are saying to them, you know, if you have any mining company in the Congo, one of the things that to ask that client that supply you is to ask you, have you made your environmental impact assessment available to communities? I think that can help because we are looking for levers how to leverage that.
For its part, Global Witness has reported for over a decade on how the Congolese state has hemorrhaged mining revenues through opaque deals, tax irregularities, and corruption. Linked to at least two of these cases is Glencore, which has pleaded guilty to bribing officials to secure improper business advantages in numerous countries, including the DRC.
Traders use code words to account for bribes which earned the Swiss firm millions in profits. That is, until the company got caught.
In December 2022, Glencore agreed to pay the DRC $180 million to settle claims arising from alleged corruption between 2007 and 2018. Civil society watchdogs say this was just a fraction of the damage done by Glencore's alleged corruption. In another notorious case in 2009, Glencore reportedly acquired a majority stake in Kamoto Copper Company, one of the DRC's biggest copper-cobalt mines, after securing a $440 million discount on the expected signing bonus due to the state-owned mining company, Gécamines. The discount alone represented 8.5% of the country's entire budget that year. So how did things get so out of control? Well, it's a story as old as colonialism. In 2002, then-President Joseph Kabila opened the doors to foreign investment following the financial collapse of Gécamines in the 1990s. International companies flocked in, entering joint ventures with Gécamines to develop industrial copper cobalt mines. Today, the export of copper has increased from under 10,000 tons to over 200,000. In December 2022, the US government signed a memorandum of understanding with the DRC and Zambia, committing to develop a, quote, integrated value chain for electric vehicle battery production in the African countries. In October 2023, both states signed a similar partnership with the EU. But as multiplying human rights and corruption concerns have pushed some Western companies to leave, Chinese companies are now taking their place.
I think that we are unlucky as communities, as Congolese, to actually see China, to take the monopoly of the mining sector. I think that one of the issues of the challenge that we are struggling here and that which we have to tackle here, they don't have standards, and that's very important. You know, standards on human rights, standards on how to engage with communities, standards on how to protect the environment. And one my understanding, because I've been working within mining sector for a very, very long time, I'm telling you, my understanding is that Chinese company approach is to be really flexible. You know, if you are able to enforce the law, you can enforce the law. Unfortunately, if you are not able, they will use this opportunity. And this is exactly what is going on here.
Jean-Pierre says his organization is working to ensure that Congolese communities are protected from these harms.
So what we do now as organization is first to limit the negative impact of all this mining operation in the Congo on communities, you know, how to make sure that communities can be protected, you know, protect their life, that they can have access to the clean water, for example, access to the hospital. That's why we continue to say that everyone, not only Congolese government, you know, all the actors along the supply chain should make sure that to make the supply chain sustainable and reliable for everyone.
I asked Alaka for her perspective on this.
China is looking at Africa very, very differently. They have a very interesting coordinated approach. They don't only come into the country to mine, they also provide infrastructure. So they, once they're bidding for those contracts, they are more likely to also bid for roads, they are more likely to bid for railways, they are more likely to bid for shipping routes. So I think it's important to realize that the problem is starting at the top, whereby when these negotiations are happening with African governments, and now, like now in DRC, as Jean-Pierre has mentioned, it's very difficult to hold them accountable because they've already negotiated with state governments to actually come in and do some of this mining. So there are no proper accountability.
I asked Alaka how she thinks African governments can and should go about improving accountability so that local communities impacted by mining can actually be properly compensated for and protected from the loss of their homes and land, as well as serious health issues. Here's what she said.
We need more African you know, decision makers to leverage on these critical minerals and not to have, you know, the people on the ground, the miners, taken advantage of. I think there's need also for technological transfer. I think the way those contracts are drafted, nobody's looking at environmental health and safety issues, the human rights abuses, environmental transfer, illicit financial flows. A lot of that is overlooked because of, you know, the nature in which these contracts are being drafted.
Hi, I'm Amy Hall, and I'm one of the co-editors at New Internationalist magazine. I wanted to take a minute to thank our amazing global network of journalists who cover the stories that the mainstream media ignores, from every continent. It's down to them that New Internationalist has been able to platform these alternative perspectives for more than 50 years and give a human face to the news. To get more of our reporting and analysis directly to your door or inbox, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist via the link in our show notes, subscribe.newint.org.
As the energy transition gathers pace, the DRC has found itself at the center of a new global scramble for resources. New mineral-related megaprojects in the DRC include the Lobito Corridor, a $6 billion rail-linked industrial network from the mines on the DRC-Zambia border all the way to the Angolan coast.
The Lobito Corridor links colonial history, civil war, and 21st century African ambitions. In Brussels, some recall that this isn't a new idea. Before the DRC gained independence in 1960, Belgian settlers in Katanga used this railway to export minerals. Originally called the Benguela Railway, it was built by the Portuguese in the early 1900s, linking the port of Lobito on Angola's Atlantic coast to the rich mines of Katanga, now part of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia.
But a lack of consultation or transparency around its implementation has left many members of civil society, including Jean-Pierre, doubtful.
People are divided here in Congo. The way they are looking at Lobito Corridor is, for most of people in Congo here, that the project aligns much with this geopolitical, you know, power, struggling over power between the USA and the Western country and China, while a few people, including from elite in Congo, think that the project will be profitable. But I think in overall situation is like, in the past, Congo signed a deal with China. That contract was called the century contract, the contract of the century, because given its potential impacts in our economy here in Congo, you know, infrastructure development and others. Unfortunately, we are so disappointed. Nothing, you know, came out from that contract. Yes, so people are about septic here in Congo, overseeing this kind of, infrastructure project.
Jean-Pierre would like to see the project deliver its promised regional integration, but he's skeptical about how it will turn out for the Congo and its people. He says one positive outcome could be from an environmental perspective, ensuring that millions of tons of copper aren't transported by road. But there's also a downside.
So Lobito can have also the negative impact of putting pressure on mineral extraction in the Congo. So let us see if the double production from Congo, what will be the consequences? What will be the impact of extraction in communities from, you know, labor conditions, human rights, as well as environment?
If the Lobito Corridor is something that is very, very important, then it means we as Africa need to figure out how to finance it so that it's not attached to loans or it's not attached to debt. Is this the Lobito Corridor another avenue to just export raw minerals out of the African continent like has been done for the last 100 years?
A few weeks after I recorded this interview with Jean-Pierre and Alaka, something major happened between the DRC and neighboring Rwanda, which will have major implications for the mining sector. In June, after decades of brutal war that has claimed millions of lives since it began in 1996, the DRC and Rwanda signed a peace deal with the help of US President Donald Trump.
And this is a long time waiting. The conflict has continued and it's been going on for many, many years.
The Rwanda-backed M23 armed group has committed widespread atrocities in the DRC, including indiscriminate killing, torture, and mass abductions. rape has routinely been used as a weapon of war, which is something our contributor Sophie Niemann has written about in a recent issue of New Internationalist. But mineral wealth is also one of the core drivers of fighting in the region, and in the past year, M23 has seized control of many lucrative mines in the eastern DRC, including the largest coltan mine on Earth, near the town of Rubaya. So while Trump was clearly very pleased with himself as he scribbled his name in thick black marker on this peace agreement, it's worth noting that the DRC and Rwanda have agreed to at least six truces since 2021, none of which has lasted. Amnesty International says this latest peace agreement fails to address justice for the victims of serious crimes by not including any provisions aimed at holding their perpetrators to account. And even before this peace agreement came into effect, Alaka was quick to point out what the US is really after.
I think it's interesting to watch that all these years that there has been conflict in DRC, that now America is then realizing that this is the best time for them to come in and, you know, and be the mediators towards peace. If America is really genuine about peace in Congo, because that's what they led with, why is it that the deal is attached to mineral supply and them securing their supply chain?
In light of this, I wanted to ask Jean-Pierre whether there is any real pathway to justice for those Congolese communities affected by mining and what role his organization plays in achieving that.
Yes, sharing revenue is good. You see, building a school is good. But from our perspective, the protection of environment is really mandatory. It's mandatory because it does make sense of sharing revenue for communities while, you know, having environment, you see, causing pollution of water, causing pollution of soil and air and everything. So for us, it's very important. So what we've been doing in terms of action here, including my organization, we continue to work for government to actually understand, to leverage the disclosure of environmental impact assessment here on the ground here. The second action is at the global level. So what we do basically is to work closely with those, you know, buyers from the global market to actually know who is buying what from where, you see. The pressure now is around the disclosure of environmental impact assessment. Once we get them, I think it will enable us to actually move forward and to engage further.
Alaka says it's also important to look at what's happening at a regional level.
The role of the African Union is to guide member states to be able to put together, as you know, sustainability around industrialization, energy security, and you know, inclusive growth and sustainability. And the reason I'm talking about it is because a few years ago, the African Mining Vision came into force, and this was advocating for what we're calling equitable mineral resource management and governance. So from a regional perspective, civil society can also draw from this green mineral strategy. And I'm also mentioning it because you see the US have their own strategy around what they're looking at to secure their supply chains. The EU has their Critical Minerals Act. And I think it's Africa has a green mineral strategy that is being piloted by the African Union. It's also important that this strategy is going to be used at a national level to elevate some of those conversations around transparency and accountability. Issues around, again, as I mentioned, issues around illicit financial flows, value addition, beneficiation, job creation, you know, net zero carbon emission, so that we can at least create an opportunity for Africa to industrialize as it benefits from its minerals, because we cannot keep exporting our minerals in raw form. So hopefully this strategy can be a roadmap towards that.
It's clear that the world's energy transition depends, at least in part, on Congolese resources, and that the DRC depends on mining. But I wanted to know, is there a way to make this industry safe, fair, and sustainable for Congolese people? What would a just transition really look like? Here's Jean-Pierre.
I'm seeing, you know, two aspects of what just energy transition like in Congo. The first one, the protection of the environment. Very important. We need to make sure that future generations in Congo can live safely in Congo. The second one just is about what is extracted from Congo. The wealth, how do we share the wealth in Congo? You know, that is very important. How do you add value in Congo?
Instead of exporting raw materials for peanuts, while other countries profit from transforming these into industrial goods, Jean-Pierre argues that the DRC should encourage domestic industrialization to boost jobs and allow the export of higher value products.
I'm so committed, and that will be the part of my life, you know, is to make sure that our government act in the manner that will enable us to actually benefit
300 million Africans on the continent do not have access to electricity. So what a just energy transition would look like is we need to secure energy and electricity for these Africans working on the continent. So it's important for us as an African continent to, and for DRC to just figure out how we can be able to leverage on these minerals in terms of value addition, in terms of job, you know, job creation, and also very, very aware of the geopolitics that is currently happening on the continent. I mean, it's not enough for us, for this revolution to actually pass us by.
That was Alaka Lugonzo, a senior civil society advisor at Global Witness, and Jean-Pierre Okenda, the executive director of Sentinel Natural Resources. We hope you've enjoyed this mini-series. Now, we want to hear from you. What are some smarter moves than digging ourselves deeper into a mining hole? We've laid out several examples in the magazine, from a hybrid renewable solution in Scotland's Isle of Eigg, to improved regulatory frameworks and economic incentives for metals recycling, to design for repair, a potential solution to our throwaway culture that is worthy of serious academic study. But what other ideas are taking shape in your community? Let us know your thoughts by sending an email to submissions@newint.org for a chance to be featured in an upcoming issue of our magazine. We can't wait to hear from you. That's it from us. Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you were inspired by what you heard today and want to support our journalism, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist magazine. You can check out our show notes, where you'll find a link to subscribe. And don't forget to use the code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout for 20% off the first year of your print and or digital subscription. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Conrad Landon, Nick Dowson, and Bethany Riley. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey, and Vanessa Baird was the contributing editor of our recent issue on critical minerals. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Foos. Audio editing is by Naseek Hamza. We'll be back soon.